Hello and welcome to the Ian's Health Podcast with me, Ian Entwistle. Today I'm joined by Sam Feltham. Sam is a personal trainer based in London. He's the owner of the Smash the Fat Fitness and Fat Loss Bootcamps, and he's also the author of an excellent new book entitled Slimology. And in this episode of the podcast, we're going to be discussing diet research over the past 15 years, whether exercise is beneficial for fat loss, and also some very interesting experiments that Sam actually conducted on himself. So without further ado, let's get into the interview and welcome Sam. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
No problem, mate.
Sam, just to kick things off, are you able to just give us a brief background of where you've come from to the point where you've ended up with the views you've currently got?
So my kind of career started about just over 5 years ago now. I used to be a snowboard instructor. And I was instructing around the world, from New Zealand to America and also throughout the Alps as well. But I kind of got to the end of that after 4 years, not wanting to snowboard for the rest of my life and wanting to do something a bit more meaningful. So kind of looking throughout all of the available professions to me. Personal training is the one that kind of spoke to me the most, the coaching element and the helping people element as well. So I studied at the European Institute of Fitness, where I qualified as a master personal trainer back in 2010. And from there, I have kind of constantly researched everything in terms of health and fitness. And it was about 4.5 years ago now that I set up my my fitness boot camps, which is Smash the Fat,
yep.
Fitness and Fat Loss Boot Camps, and kind of from there helping people and also having discussions as well, which is incessantly online as well. I've come to conclude that what I was actually advising at the start, which was basically eat less, move more, doesn't tend to work in the long term, certainly, and that there's probably a better way of doing things as well.
Yeah, I mean, your profile is actually not dissimilar to mine, but I was going to ask you was, did you, so prior to that, had you, is that what you'd kind of generally gone with, the eat less, move more and calories in, calories out kind of argument, and that was your general way of thinking? Was there something that was there a point that altered that?
It was along those lines of eat less and move more. I mean, I think I was probably a bit more helpful in my approach instead of just literally just saying eat less and move more. As I kind of say this in my book, that bad things not only happen when good people do nothing, but bad things happen when good people give unsound advice as well, unfortunately, even though their intentions are all meaningful and well thought out. And there was a point, it was kind of about 6 months into being a PT and a boot camp instructor as well, that you start to discover that sort of giving people that sort of advice doesn't really create the results that you want. And so I went on a bit of a fact-finding mission, came across the book Why We Get Fat by Gary Torbs, which I'm sure many people have. And it kind of opened a can of worms, basically. And from there, I've kind of been advising carbohydrate restriction and smart exercise as the starting point for somebody to become healthier.
Yeah, I mean, that Gary Torbs has probably, I'm sure, sparked off many a change of thought. You mentioned when you just said then about your book, which is an excellent little resource actually, and so you know, congratulations on that.
Thanks.
The one of the things you made a point of in the book is you've tallied up sort of fairly recent research in diet. What would be your summary of that? With you talk a lot about randomized controlled trials, which I want to ask you about in a second actually, but what's the last sort of 15 years or so, what did you detail in your book there, that you know, the upshot of that?
So in the book Slimology, I kind of did my own meta-analysis, basically, because all of the meta-analyses, when it comes to randomized controlled trials between different diets, when they compare carbohydrate restriction, they don't really always include proper carbohydrate restriction. So some of the trials that they include can be anywhere up to 40% carbohydrates, yeah, which obviously isn't carbohydrate restriction, nice, unless it's a 1,000 calorie diet.
So still a high volume there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. It's still a high volume. So I kind of did my own meta-analysis, seeing that it hadn't really been done for true carbohydrate restriction, which is 20% or less, or at least 130 grams a day or less, ideally kind of, you know, at the start 50 grams or less, and then moving up to 100 grams to 50 grams. But I collated all of this. Turns out there's about 25 randomized controlled trials over the past 15 years. And what those randomized controlled trials show between the carbohydrate restricted diets and low fat diets, it shows that carbohydrate restricted diets result in 65% more weight loss despite eating a little bit more, basically the same, statistically insignificant differences, but they eat a little bit more that can't be accounted for due to protein in terms of the weight loss, because low-fat dieters eat more dietary fiber as well, and then also they become 3.5 times healthier as well. And just to give you kind of which markers were there.
Yeah.
In terms of triglycerides, over those 25, 17 of those 25 randomized controlled trials showed significant decreases in triglycerides for low carb diets, but only for 3 in low fat diets.
Right.
And then when it comes to HDL, which is the good cholesterol, you want that to be going up. In terms of that, 9 of the 25 showed that low-carb diets increased HDL significantly, but only once did it happen in low-fat diets. So basically, you lose more weight, you become healthier, and also in those trials, people adhere more to low-carb diets as well. So kind of my conclusion is why is this not the default diet that we recommend people? Because the current advice from the NHS is basically to count calories on a low-fat diet, and you've got to do at least an hour of exercise a day, which is impossible for some people, even though you can kind of be active for about an hour a day, an hour of exercise a day, they say. And the 25 randomized controlled trials of the past 15 years have shown pretty much the opposite to what they're advising.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting. I take one of the points you've made there is as well. You've obviously made the issue of the what the research shows, but one thing you've mentioned repeatedly is randomized controlled trials. Now, probably it's worth pointing out that there's a large volume of turbo research gets done in nutrition, and quite often a lot of studies are observational. What's the importance of the randomized controlled trials for you?
That's a really good question, Ian, because this is really, really important. So as you said there, most nutrition studies are epidemiological or observational. It means that you look at populations and you look for correlations through a population. So kind of the most famous one is the initial study that kicked off all of this kind of mess in nutrition at the moment by Ansel Keys,
Seven
Countries study. And he showed a correlation of heart attacks with increased intake of dietary fat. And he only included 7 countries there, and the problem is that there was 22 countries that he had available data at the time, and that doesn't show any correlation at all. In fact, it kind of shows that the more animal products that people eat, the less death that there is. So it kind of, you know, blows it all out of the water.
Yeah, it's astounding really how that it just gathers momentum and that's the end of it, isn't it?
it really does. It snowballs from there. So the problem is that with observational studies is that you can't necessarily prove to any certain extent that the correlation equals causation.
Yeah.
So the point that you do with randomized controlled trials is that you're literally comparing two things at once, or even more than two, you're just comparing things at once. So it's basically, I compare it to an athletics relay race. So for instance, you could have two groups of four people running a 4x100 meter race, and whoever comes out the quickest out of that is the team that wins, basically. And this is what a randomized controlled trial is that you put people into groups and you give them a certain strategy to follow, for instance, a low carb diet or a low fat diet, and you try and have them try and recruit the same type of people in terms of, you know, their weight, their age, even their gender. And then you put them against each other for anywhere between 4 weeks to 2 years, for instance, which is kind of what these randomized controlled trials that I did my book on did. And whoever kind of, you know, loses the most weight and becomes the healthiest, it's kind of, you know, that's the one that wins.
Yeah, of course.
And with these 25, in every single one, low carb diets beat low fat diets in weight loss and in health markers as well. And if you get an effect as consistent as 25 randomized controlled trials in a row, you're going to assume that that's pretty much going to happen every single time.
Yeah, it's quite compelling, that, isn't it? It is really interesting. But like we said, we're so entrenched in this, you know, low fat being the way forward. I mean, I think that's probably altering a little bit more recently. But there are, I mean, if you talk to people, perhaps of maybe that little bit older who have been around and have been told and are now coming into the situation of where they're a bit aware of cholesterol scores and things like this, it's quite a difficult job to convince them or to, you know, for someone that's been indoctrinated for many years in that the animal products, the fat is bad. It's quite hard turning that around. You know, you will face that like I do daily, probably. But
absolutely,
you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? I suppose the more people, it's, you know, we can get on board, the better. Or just not even getting on board. It's not like it's an opinion. It's just what the evidence shows. You know,
that's right. That's the problem. You kind of show this evidence, and it's like, look, literally, I'm showing you an effect that shows it in 25 randomized controlled trials back to back. And you're just not believing me because why?
Yeah.
Because you feel it's wrong in some sort of way. And as you say, it's just following the data.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's following the evidence. If, for instance, low-fat diets were proved 25 times in a row to be more effective than low-carb diets, I'd put my hands up and say, look, low-fat diets are clearly, you know, the way to go. But they're not.
Well, you'd want to do the good. I mean, the good thing about all this is we're able to apply it to ourselves, and ultimately that can always be your final argument. You know, they can do, yes, or you can do what you want to do. I will do what I want to do, or what I feel's right, and we can apply it to ourselves. It's not like advice that, you know, we maybe don't follow or we don't follow, you know, all the time. So it's always the final thing. You in particular did something quite interesting, which is probably useful to talk about, is you actually experimented on yourself. So we've got the trials, which obviously detail the evidence as such, and your experiments, whilst they're a study of just one person, you. They were quite interesting, and they were quite startling, I thought, in the simplicity of how you showed that, you know, the basically the outcome of the information you've just talked about. So what was the first experiment you did where you went on a low carb, high fat diet?
So yeah, as you say, I did these self experiments, because those randomized controlled trials, that's kind of like the hardcore science evidence base. But these self experiments that I did overfeeding experiments where I ate almost 6,000 calories a day of different diets. And this first one, the low carb, high fat diet of real foods, I ended up in a net calorie surplus of 47,500.
And you'd done calories. That, and you'd done that because you'd worked out what your daily calorie requirement was, and you were over that by what, a couple of thousand or more, maybe.
Oh, a couple of thousand a day.
Yeah.
Easy. Actually, in fact, more. And it's kind of more like 2,500 almost. So the net calorie surplus is the actual amount of calorie surplus that I was in after minusing any exercise, the basic BMR, my dietary fiber intake, my protein intake, and everything like that, all of the basics.
Yeah.
And after that 47,500 calorie surplus, I basically ended up putting on 1.3 kilos or just under 3 pounds. And the calorie formula says I should have put on just over 6 kilograms.
Yeah, something's gone.
Or just shy of a stone. Yeah, something's gone totally wrong.
Something's gone missing there, hasn't it?
Exactly. And the thing is that I actually lost 3 centimeters from my waist, or just over an inch. Something's gone totally awry.
Yeah, you've lost. Did you? I don't know whether you did actually, because I remember watching these experiments you did at the time. But did you do things like body composition, fat percentage, and things like that?
I did a bod pod for the second one, and in fact, I wish I'd kind of done one at the beginning of this one, of the first one, but I did one at the end, and it was 12.7%.
Yeah, I mean, you've lost something there, haven't you? If you've lost, what is it, 3 centimeters off your waist,
mm-hmm.
eating an overeat of 47,000 calories, there's something there.
Yeah, something up here.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes to show it's not exactly all about pure calories. It's not about quantity necessarily, even though they may have their place, and I might go into that later on. But I did a second follow-up experiment after 3 months, just to prove my point further. Because you can learn a bit from one experiment, but if you do multiple experiments to try and either confirm or disprove your hypothesis, then even better.
Yeah.
So I did the exact opposite. So I went high carb, low fat, fake foods. And on that self-experiment, I also ended up in a 47,500 calorie surplus.
Yeah.
Almost exactly the same. In fact, it was like 63 calorie difference
in terms of
the net calorie surplus. And after that self experiment, I ended up putting on 7.1 kilos or just shy of 16 pounds, so over a stone.
Yeah.
I put on 3.5 inches around my waist, or 9.25 centimeters. And it absolutely blew me away, the amazing difference between the two. It really was kind of mind-blowing for myself. I didn't think that I was going to put on that much. And even so, the calorie formula predicted that I'd only put on 6.1 kilograms, and I actually put on a kilogram more.
Yeah, I mean, you can't put that down either, because you've done the two experiments. You can't put that down to your ability to handle volume, is it? Your ability, obviously, to handle a certain type of food, which just shows you, I suppose. What I mean, I spoke to Zoe Harcombe a few weeks ago, and she will always say, and I've said this for, you know, what the calories are is so much more important than how many. And I mean, like you've just said, it's not insignificant. Calorie numbers aren't insignificant, but what you have here, you've had the same number of calories, and yet such a big difference in how much weight you've gained, and your composition, because your composition was clearly so much different. I mean, 3 inches on your waist, that's not a small amount, is it?
No, and not for a naturally slim guy like myself either. It certainly wasn't insignificant.
Yeah, and then I was just going to say, actually, what one of the other things, when you've been doing this, I don't know, what did you feel like?
On the first experiment, I was absolutely fine. In fact, I kind of, my energy increased, my mood was consistent, and my sleeping was absolutely fine. But then on the second experiment, I, after 3 days of kind of feeling like I was indulging myself and having a bit of a laugh, started to feel like absolute crap, basically. Right. My mood was going all over the place. My sleep was broken. And whenever I was doing exercise, I was seriously out of breath.
Right.
As well. Because I'm mildly asthmatic, and anybody that's asthmatic, if you haven't tried carbohydrate restriction, it's a surefire way to reduce your asthmatic symptoms.
That's interesting, actually, because I've not even read that actually anyway. Is that something that's common?
Yeah, it's really common. Really common. So it really has a big handle on your blood pressure. And that kind of has a knock-on effect in terms of your VO2 max as well, and kind of your oxygen capacity as well. So it's, if you do have kind of asthmatic symptoms a lot, then reduce your carbohydrate consumption, and that'll certainly alleviate
did
it.
How different? So the first obvious experiment you did where you felt good, and which was the low carb, high fat. How different would that be from? Was that with your normal diet? Would you say? Was it at that point?
Yes, pretty much.
And were you just eating more calories than normal? Would you say? Yeah.
It was pretty much just more quantity,
right?
Basically. Almost twice as much quantity as I normally eat. It's basically what I eat on a daily basis. I mean, I do include a bit of rice and sweet potato on workout days at lunchtime, only one portion on a workout day. But apart from that, that's pretty much it, really.
Yeah. So what happened then when you went on because you did a third experiment, which was the high carb, low fat one, but this was with real food. So not the fake food garbage you were eating for the second experiment. You were eating, what was it, things like rice, potatoes, vegetables, things like this?
Yeah, that's right. And fruit and all the good stuff. And the interesting thing here is that it's completely vegan.
Yeah.
So no animal products at all. And over those 21 days, I ended up in a 39,500 calorie surplus.
Yeah.
So almost, it's like almost 8,000 calorie difference from the other two. And actually on that experiment, I put on 4.7 kilos. So quite a bit more than the first experiment, despite an 8,000 calorie
less
deficit.
Yeah,
as well. Yeah, less as well. So it's absolutely bizarre, really.
Yeah, and your waist went up by 3 inches, I think. Yeah
it did. Yeah,
I mean, that's crazy, that, isn't it? That you've responded.
It really is.
Yeah, it's a shit. I mean, I obviously it's a difficult one, the animal products one, because I mean, you'll see people who, it's an ethical choice for them. It's not because of the health issue, and that's a different discussion. But for health purposes, it seems crazy.
Yeah, and I mean the thing is though, Ian, is that we've kind of known about this for the past 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
The carbohydrates have a massive regulatory, I'm trying to think of a good word for it, regulatory decision maker in terms of how much body fat that you're going to hold on your body, basically, since we were able to measure the amount of insulin that people actually secrete and have in their body at any one time. And also the fact that it regulates the triglycerides in your blood as well.
Yeah.
And it's called carbohydrate-induced hypertriglyceremia.
Yeah.
So I always get it wrong.
Yeah, you go. It's a tough one, that one.
It's a tongue twister.
Rather you than me,
That's it. We've known about the fact that carbohydrates regulate the amount of triglycerides in the blood for ages, and it's kind of that knocks on to body fat as well. So if you want, if you're wanting to lose body fat and even get healthier, then the first thing to try is to reduce the amount of carbohydrates that you're eating, basically.
Well, like you say, it's a big knock-on effect, isn't it? The insulin, the leptin, the the cortisol, all these hormones that have almost a domino effect with insulin. Mentioning the insulin actually is brings us on actually to the next bit, which is really interesting, because obviously insulin is something we hear talked about quite a lot, particularly in regard to diabetes. And, and we're in a situation where more and more people are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. But one point you made really well in your book, actually, and it's something that I'd kind of observed, but you made a point of it well, was Steve Redgrave. Obviously, he's a multiple Olympic champion. I mean, who knows how much exercise that guy was doing at the time? Lots.
Lots is the answer.
He got his fifth gold medal, and you made an observation in the book that I'd made in the past. We've probably watched the same things, and I've looked at Steve Redgrave as an Olympic athlete getting his gold medal. And you do look at him in the rowing outfit, which you know doesn't leave too much room for error, and you're thinking, Steve Redgrave looks like he's carrying a bit of spare weight, but you kind of pass over and think, well, you know, it obviously didn't stop him getting his gold medal. So, but Steve Redgrave was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes not long before the Sydney Olympics. And I mean, what was your point of that? That was quite an interesting point you made. What was that in the book?
Yeah, so I call this the Redgrave paradox. And it's exactly that when Steve Redgrave, Sir Steve Redgrave, won his fifth Olympic gold medal, he was carrying a spare flat tyre around his waist. It wasn't a tyre, it was a flat tyre. So you could see there was excess body fat on his body. All of his athletic counterparts were slim as any athlete that you can imagine. But him in particular was carrying a bit of extra weight, and despite that, he still managed to get a gold medal. Yeah. In his fifth at that. And it was 3 years prior that he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And if the key to losing body fat and getting healthier was purely just down to counting calories and exercising more, then the Redgrave paradox kind of disproves that.
Yeah.
Because he was exercising undoubtedly at least 6 days a week, probably doing 2 a days, you know, 6 hours a day at least.
Yeah. I mean, full-time occupation, wasn't it?
Yeah, full-time occupation. And, you know, to get to Olympic gold standards, you got to be doing that. And the problem with Steve Redgrave is that when he started his professional career, he started in the 80s. And the 80s was when we really started to push the whole low-fat dogma, as well as the carb loading at the same time. So undoubtedly through his career, he's been carb loading like there's no tomorrow. And unfortunately, that's left him, despite exercising massive amounts almost every single day, he still ended up type 2 diabetic.
Yeah.
And that's because of the amount of carbohydrates that he was eating and the knock-on effect of insulin secreting through his body, basically. And that left him with a spare flat tire around his tummy at the Olympic finals of the Coxless Four, unfortunately.
Yeah, and having an impaired ability to handle carbohydrates,
for the rest of his life.
Yeah, having eaten so many, I imagine he will have been eating a lot to sustain that level of exercise anyway, and so probably will have had insulin coursing through his bloodstream, I don't know, most of the day, I imagine.
Constantly. It would have been constant.
Yeah, I mean, I remember hearing actually, because I remember someone, in the past when I was competing, I remember someone saying to me about jelly babies. And this was a good 10, 15 years ago, and saying, oh, well, Steve Redgrave and Matt Pinsent, they always they have jelly babies before they go out and compete. In other words, well, therefore we must do it. You know, it must be the thing to do. And it's the same thing as what you just said. Maybe I imagine they probably were just eating lots and lots of sort of just sugar, really, you know, to get, you know, sustain that kind of short-term level of expenditure that they would need.
Undoubtedly. And unfortunately, that's left them with a quarantined amount of body fat on them.
Yeah.
So no matter how much kind of exercise that they do, they're always going to kind of carry that body fat unless they start to bring down their insulin levels, which is kind of the most important thing in terms of losing weight and becoming healthier, certainly.
Yeah.
The way that you kind of do that is by restricting carbohydrates as a starting point. I mean, exercise helps as well in terms of bringing down your insulin levels and also increasing your insulin sensitivity.
Yeah.
Hence why he wasn't carrying a full-blown tire around his belly, but he was just carrying a bit of a flat tire around his belly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, his exercise undoubtedly kind of put it off for longer because he was just burning through the carbohydrates. But in terms of that, the knock-on effect of that is that for the rest of his life, he's going to be type 2 diabetic, undoubtedly, and also seriously increasing his risk of heart disease and cancer as well, with those high levels of insulin coursing through his veins. I'd recommend Steve to go on a carb restricted diet.
I'd be interested to see what Matt Pinson's state was actually, because he was never you would never look at Matt Pinson when he was competing and say he was absolutely ripped, would you? You know, like
that's a good point actually.
You know, I mean, James Cracknell, I think he always looked like that kind of guy. I mean, I think obviously his genetics plays a part, but Matt Pinson was kind of, you never looked at him and thought he was a big fella. They all were big guys, weren't they? But you never looked and thought. So I'd be interested. I don't know what his state is. I've not seen him for a while.
I'm trying to think. Kind of, I mean, last time I saw him on TV, he was certainly carrying a few more pounds. I'm trying to think in that photo as well, whether or not.
He was probably more like, he was sort of, because he was younger than Steve Redgrave, but he looked. You get some guys, don't you, have a certain shape. He was a big fella and not a ripped fella like James Cracknell was more like that. But that's interesting because on that background, what would be the exercise then you would say that has been more useful? I know, I mean, because we see a lot of people that it's quite accessible for them to do, you know, cardio type workouts, so running, cycling, and they can, you know, they can get out and do quite a lot of this. What do you think that's the best thing for their weight loss and controlling these health markers, or would there be something else that's better?
And the first thing is that diet rules all, basically.
Yeah, agreed.
So carbohydrate restriction first, but then in terms of exercise, the best exercise to do in terms of reducing your insulin levels and increasing your insulin sensitivity is firstly strength training.
Right.
However you do that, it could be through body weight training. I do a lot of that myself. It could be through resistance bands. It could be through actual dumbbell and barbell work, or it could be through kind of, you know, being part of a tug of war team.
Yeah,
you know, it could be.
Well, what you're basically saying is pushing or pulling against some kind of resistance, aren't you? Whether that be gravity or a dumbbell or the other tug of war team, whatever that might be.
Exactly that, and then that in turn increases your muscle mass, and so then your body becomes more insulin sensitive, and it's better to able to deal with any insulin and glucose and insulin that comes with that, that's kind of the starting point for it. And then on top of that, you can do interval training as well, kind of just basic HIIT stuff, or even Tabata as well, just really super quick stuff, which will help out certainly as well. Not as effective as strength training, but still helps you out in terms of becoming more insulin sensitive, but more along the lines of cardiovascular fitness.
Because you would say that obviously we in the business you're in, and also the business that I'm in, which is health and exercise, effectively. You say, and I agree that exercise is not the key to fat loss or to weight loss, fat loss, and but it does have a benefit, and its benefit where it does impact those is not through the calorie expenditure, is it? It's not through just burning off 200-300 whatever calories you may burn off in a workout. That's clearly not the benefit. You would say the benefit's in its biochemical effects.
Yeah, that's right. The benefits of exercise have only ever really been in terms of improved blood markers, really. It's never been in fat loss. And even though the government keep on kind of pushing it as being the key to solving the obesity epidemic, even in their own report, the way that they prove it is with a study that shows that exercise alone only decreases body weight by 5%, but diet with exercise decreases it by 16%, and diet alone decreased it by 17%.
No, that was a bit of a crit. I saw that one. It's quite an interesting one, that, isn't it?
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
The study kind of disproves the exercise is as effective as, say, diet. For instance, yeah, they're sort of saying, yeah, exercise is the way to go and things like this.
Yeah.
It's only ever been in terms of cardiovascular benefit, cognitive benefits as well, in terms of reducing factors of Alzheimer's and dementia and things like that, and reducing depression, anxiety and stress, which is probably its most important benefit, actually, I'd say, in terms of reducing stress, because the only reason that we got stressed in the past was when we were either in a fight with a fellow human, or we're getting chased by a lion, basically. And because of that, we immediately exercise. So we're immediately exercising at the time that we become stressed. And these days, we only really get stressed whether it be in a relationship or in work, and there's not an immediate exercise response to that. And so we don't burn off the cortisol. And also with cortisol, cortisol makes you secrete the glycogen that you've got stored. Yeah. And so the knock-on effect of that is increased insulin levels as well. And if you are exercising, you burn that off straight away. But if you're at work, you have a stressful meeting, and then you don't burn it off by fighting your boss, for instance, then it's just going to be secreting through your veins. So the most beneficial thing exercise is for is for stress.
Yeah, so it has, I mean, it probably has, I mean, like you just said, the stress is so different as well. It's this, where a lot of people are under stress chronically rather than, like, all day long, rather than this acute bout of fight or flight type response situation. And so probably, I mean, you would agree that obviously exercise certainly has its place, and it kind of helps with fat loss in a, via the back door, doesn't it, really, by improving the other things to help it, not in reducing calories or increasing your burning of calories. That's probably the message, isn't it? So we'd still say exercise is a big thing to do, just perhaps not beneficial perhaps in quite the same way or as useful, certainly in fat loss, as you would say.
Oh, certainly, because you'll look at people kind of racking up the calories on a treadmill or a bike or a cross trainer or whatever, and they're like, yeah, I burned 500 calories. Probably not.
Yeah.
But they're counting the calories because that's something that's easily quantifiable, even though those things aren't accurate in any way at all.
Yeah.
But it's something that's quantifiable to them, so they feel that that's a benefit. The real benefit is, as you say, through the health biomarkers, people should exercise, undoubtedly, certainly not saying that, but in terms of just burning calories, it's not really a benefit.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Right. Well, Sam, that is that's excellent. That and like I said, the book is excellent. That's Slimology. Yeah, thanks for talking to us.
No problem at all. And if anybody's got any questions, just let me know. Always happy to answer.
And that was Sam Feltham, the personal trainer and author of the book Slimology, which is available on Amazon. Like Sam said, if you'd like to get in touch, he is available on Facebook at Smash the Fat Fitness and Fat Loss Bootcamps and also on Twitter at Sam Feltham. And of course, you can always get in touch with us here at Ian's Health via the website, which is ianshealth.co.uk, and also via Facebook and Twitter. So thanks for listening. And until the next time, keep trying to live the healthy life.